shooting from the lip and never half-cocked, giving you full disclosure. This is The Debriefer.
Hello, I'm Donna Ballman. I'm a lawyer here in sunny South Florida and author of The Writer's Guide to the Courtroom, Let's Quill All the Lawyers, here with Peter Cox, London literary agent extraordinaire. This week, we have a special guest, Robert Sharp, who is the campaigns manager of English Pen. He's here to speak with us about libel reform in the UK and to tell us about the latest draft bill that is being published this month. Hello, Robert, and welcome to The Debriefer.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, it's our pleasure. We've been talking about a lot of stories that were really concerning about British libel laws since we began broadcasting in 2007 here on Radio Latopia, but some of our listeners won't know what's going on. Can you summarize briefly for us why there's a movement to reform UK libel laws?
Well, it's very difficult to summarize it briefly, but I'll do my best. Basically, the libel laws in this country, or rather the libel laws of England and Wales, because our Scottish brothers and sisters have a slightly different legal system. But here in England and Wales, the law is just out of balance, and it's been out of balance since it was created a couple of hundred years ago. So it's a law for rich people that serves rich people. What it doesn't serve is freedom of speech or the truth. And we finally think we might have a breakthrough. And the current parliament, the current government, might actually change the laws in favour of free speech.
Well, tell us about English Pen. What's it about, and what's their involvement in the libel reform movement?
Well, Pen is an international fellowship of writers. Over in the States, you have a Pen American Centre. In fact, I think you have two American Pens. And we've got 144 centres in 110 countries, I think. English Pen is the founding centre, so we were established in London in 1921, which I think makes us one of the oldest human rights organisations in the world. Our first president was John Galsworthy, who wrote the Forsyte Saga and many other novels, won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And our second president was H.G. Wells, and it was Wells who actually did a lot of writing on the modern ideas of free speech, inspired the Declaration of Human Rights. And since Wells, there've been, I think, 25 more English Pen presidents. The latest is Gillian Slovo, the South African and British novelist and writer. And we campaign for the promotion of literature across frontiers. And we think that the freedom to read and the freedom to write is what keeps the world going, what keeps democracy going, but also what keeps art going as well. So that's our mission. That's our campaign. And I'm very honoured to be playing a small part in the organisation.
Well, we're so glad to have you here because this is such an important issue. Peter just brought to my attention a guy named Fred Goodwin, who seems to have run something called a bank, just got a super injunction.
Sure.
It's to a
keep
Sir
from
Fred.
Being called
Sir
a
Fred
banker.
He did.
And I guess he doesn't believe in that, you know, rose by any other name.
Let's just take a step back and ask Robert to explain exactly what a super injunction is, because
exactly.
I think everyone knows what an injunction is, but a super injunction.
Well, yeah, an injunction, as your listeners will know, allows a judge to stop a publisher from publishing something, or indeed a radio show from publishing their podcast if they say something they shouldn't.
So you've got to be careful.
It's very often in cases of privacy where you've invaded someone's privacy, but also if you've infringed someone's copyright, or indeed if you've said something defamatory, and the person in question or the company in question gets wind of it before you've published it, they publish an injunction. Now, sometimes what the newspapers will do is they will say in their newspaper, we have been told we can't publish details about this, that, or the other. So the claimant, the person bringing the suit, will ask for a super injunction, which means that papers can't even report the fact that they've been injuncted. And so,
and yet they've been reporting that they've gotten a super injunction. So tell me why we now know about it.
Well, because of a very clever and welcome loophole, which is that anything said in Parliament is protected by absolute privilege.
So they've got free speech there.
So the parliamentarians have got free speech. They can breach people's privacy and copyright. They can also libel people. Anything said by MPs in the parliamentary chamber or the parliamentary select committees is totally protected from the courts and the censors in this way. I say last year, in 2009, an oil company, Trafigura, were being investigated for dumping toxic waste in the Ivory Coast. They took out a super injunction to stop the Guardian newspaper and the BBC reporting on what they'd done. And the BBC couldn't even say that they'd been injuncted. So the problem with super injunctions and why it's such a horrible thing for free speech is that censoring is happening and we don't know it's happening. And that's the most sinister form of censorship.
Well, we say that libel has a chilling effect
absolutely,
on free speech.
Absolutely.
A super injunction has a freezing effect.
Absolutely.
You just don't know about it, do you?
Yeah, you just don't know
it's
happened. You would think that these companies are in good standing. You might invest in them, and you might you would lose your money when it came out, or you might just have ethical issues against that company. So it's for the sake of democracy and this for the sake of business, a lot of corruption investigations are super injuncted in that way.
Now, another concern that we hear about is libel tourism. Tell
yes.
me what that is and why it's become a concern.
Okay, so this is the phenomenon whereby a foreign defendant, and I just mean that to mean someone not in the not British, will sue a foreign claimant will sue a foreign defendant in the British courts. Which is very bizarre.
Now, why would two perfectly foreigners come to these shores to sue each other?
Because, they don't sue each other. One
All
person,
right, yes.
one person gets sued, and the other
yes.
person is the suee, if you like. The claimant chooses to sue here because the court is, I forget my metaphor now, the playing field is sloped so much in their favour that the defendant doesn't really have a chance. So the costs of defending a libel action in the UK are 140 times more expensive than elsewhere in Europe.
Good grief.
That's a study that came out of the...
It's the rich man's game.
Yeah, that's the Oxford Centre of Socio-Legal Studies, I think, published that. Those figures. So it's absolutely a rich man's game.
Well, my favorite case of libel tourism was this one against Rachel Ehrenfeld.
Sure.
In 2004. She was sued by a Saudi billionaire she accused of financing terrorism in a book called Funding Evil.
Yeah.
And she only sold 23 copies through Amazon in Britain, and yet he managed to successfully sue her and get $225,000, £150,000
wow.
In judgment. And she had no contacts, nothing in Britain, but there she was sued.
Absolutely. And the question that we are the campaign are raising about that case is, was the Sheikh's reputation in the UK damaged? I'm absolutely convinced it was damaged in the USA because Rachel Ehrenfeld sold a lot of copies.
Yeah.
But 23 copies
23
sold
people.
In these were US published editions that had been bought via the international Amazon site. 23
yeah.
copies came to the UK.
Yeah.
Wasn't published in the UK. So,
well, the good news about that case is that it kind of raised consciousness here, and states started passing laws, and now the U.S. Congress actually thought your laws were so bad that we've passed a law here that doesn't allow most of your libel judgments to be recognized here in the U.S.
But the thing is, Donna, just from putting my agent's hat on, which I haven't really taken off actually since last week, that's a bit smelly. The thing is that we do talk about this chilling effect. And it's all very well for states and maybe even at federal level, I don't know, for laws to be passed. But actually, what happens in the UK is the most important thing. And until we do reform things here, things ain't going to change. And I can tell you, on a very, very practical basis, that not one book gets published here or considered for publication without the publisher thinking very hard, is there any way we are going to get hauled into the courts for this book?
The publishers obviously employ their own lawyers to do a legal read of any book, especially books on politics, memoir, investigative journalism. I was talking to Michaela Wrong, who's an investigative journalist, New Statesman columnist here. She published a really good book called, It's Our Turn to Eat, about corruption in Kenya. Inspired by the sort of the WikiLeaks revelations as well, back in the day. But that's a separate free speech issue. But Michaela, I was talking to about libel. Her book was libel read, and it stretched to 80 pages.
Oh yeah.
And names that had been published elsewhere, that had been talked about in Kenya, were removed.
Came
from
out
the
for
British,
the UK edition.
For the UK edition.
Yeah. So how does that serve the UK readership? It doesn't at all.
No,
it
absolutely.
It puts us at a disadvantage compared to anywhere else in the world.
Worse than that, it puts the rest of the world at a disadvantage as well because of libel tourism. If the revelations are published in full elsewhere, the claimants will still come UK to sue because London, especially an international city, lot of people can claim that they've got some tangible, tenuous reputation here. So it's not just that UK free speech is being harmed. It's that people overseas are being harassed and hassled and censored and bullied by UK lawyers threatening...
The UN Committee on Human Rights actually issued a report that your libel laws negatively affected freedom of expression around the world. How does it feel to be right up there with countries like China on free speech?
I mean, it was, you know, embarrassing, frankly. And thankfully that, and the fact that your US legislators helpfully called the law, the libel terrorism law, when they were sort of, never mind being put in the same boat as China, put in the same boat as Osama bin Laden. So, and that actually did have a really that made British parliamentarians stand up and take notice. And the people who started looking into this was the Select Committee for the Culture, Media and Sport. A group of a scrutiny group.
So you can actually track it back to that moment.
It was a combination of factors. It was the UN report. It was this Oxford report I mentioned.
Yeah.
It was Rachel Ehrenfeld. Other cases in the UK. Simon Singh, the science writer, wrote a book called Trickle Treatment. He wrote an article in The Guardian about chiropractic. And the British Chiropractic Association sued him. They refused any sort of right of reply from The Guardian. They wanted to get Simon Singh. Simon, because he's a very tenacious, almost fundamentalist in his belief of free speech, actually risked a lot of money to go to court.
Well, it is always a huge financial risk that most writers actually couldn't take because most writers don't earn very much money. But it's also, I think it's worth saying, it's also a huge psychological risk too, isn't it? Because you get drawn into a big action like that and it takes over your life.
Absolutely. I mean, I was talking to Ben Goldacre, another science writer. He also defended a case against a South African vitamin pill manufacturer called Matthias Roth. It was a ridiculous case. It had no chance of winning, but Roth pursued it and pursued it. Ben Goldacre won eventually, along with The Guardian. And The Guardian and Ben Goldacre are now £170,000 out of pocket.
Jeez.
And
that's crazy.
That's to defend themselves successfully for things that were true against a nutter.
So what's in the new libel reform bill that's going to help solve these problems?
Well, we've been campaigning on a number of fronts, actually. It's libels are sort of hydra. There's issues over fair comment and honest opinion. There's the costs. There's the bringing the law up to date to take in, ideas of the internet. But what we're hoping, I mean, the bill will be published by the government next week. But we think they are going to strike out more trivial claims where there is no jurisdiction here. We think they're going to give us stronger defences on public interest, the idea that especially if you're talking about what the government are doing, government officials, then, even if you do get it wrong or you weren't quite right or you didn't have all the facts, you can still raise something because it's important to talk about
public
this in
interest
the
defense. Never really has existed in the UK, has it? Much?
No, I mean, it's we've got something called the Reynolds defense, which is a sort of a case, bit of case
like
law.
The Heimlich maneuver.
It's actually named after Albert Reynolds, the prime minister former prime minister of Ireland, who sued and won against the Times newspaper. But during that defence, and all the way to the House of Lords, the Lords very helpfully laid out certain areas of responsible journalism. So had you checked your sources? Had you given a right of reply? And lots of other things that a responsible journalist should do. So there was that sort of basket. And then there was another case called Jameel, which was, again, to do with sort of Saudi millionaires and the funding of terrorism that sort of increase that. But recently another case called Flood and is about a policeman suing the Daily Telegraph, I think. It looks like he might win that case, which rolls back that case law. Everything that the Telegraph published in that case was true. This man was being investigated for corruption. And they said that he was alleged. They didn't say he was a
corrupt. Important A word.
They said alleged. They said this is ongoing investigation. But Mr. Flood sued. And so what we want and what we're campaigning for and what we're demanding of MPs is that these kind of responsible journalism, responsible writing defences, because it includes bloggers and, you know, as well, responsible defences are actually in statute,
it turns
in law.
Statute. So it's not just up to each individual judge to take a view.
Absolutely, because that gives so much more certainty when you receive a letter, a threatening letter from a lawyer. If you've got that law behind you and you've ticked it against the law, you know, that reduces the chilling effect.
I think our listeners in the U.S. are going to be surprised that you don't have anything like the First Amendment here.
No, we don't.
You don't have any laws that really strongly protect journalists.
No.
And here you to get away with suing for a defamation on an article, you'd have to show actual malice on the part of a reporter, and truth is the complete defense.
One thing I will slightly disagree with you there. It's not that there aren't any protections for journalists. Rich journalists working for rich newspapers, media barons, they've got a lot of protections when they want to make rude comments and defamatory remarks against me.
That's true.
It's because of the high costs. It's as you said, Peter. It's a rich man's game. And this is the thing in the culture in the UK, at least. I don't know how it compares to the USA, but you know, we do think there should be a right to reputation. If you are smeared, if people tell lies about you, you should have a way to stop that and to get those false allegations.
That's a very
removed.
Interesting point, actually, Robert. Because I mean, I was in this situation a few years ago, and without going into too much detail, I had a couple of quite big pieces written about me. One of which was fair enough, actually, and it had to do with my involvement with a certain pop star whose name won't be mentioned. The other one was completely fabricated, to the extent that it was two or three pages in a tabloid newspaper, and every word was completely wrong. It was reported conversation that had never existed and so on. And, you know, you've got to take a view, really. What are you going to do? I mean, there's nothing, actually. Nothing that an ordinary person can do if they are taken apart by a tabloid newspaper.
Absolutely.
And they're not guilty. Because they're not rich, they have no recourse.
You write a letter to the to the newspapers and they laugh in your face and they say, we'll see you in court £200,000 later. The other thing, which doesn't look like it's going to be in the bill, but it's something that Index on Censorship and English Pen will be working on this year, is alternative dispute resolution, a fast-track, low-cost way that we can get libel redress. And that'll work for both people. It'll work for normal members of the public who get sued, but it'll also work for journalists who can very quickly clarify what they meant, correct things that go wrong. And I think that's one of the silver bullets.
So it's
actually
taking the casino element out of libel. Because
absolutely,
that's one of the things that really appeals to your high rollers, isn't
yeah
it? That, you know, you pay a lot of money and you really could win big time.
You could.
Now, an alternative dispute resolution, are we talking mediation and arbitration or just one?
This is what we are going to research this year. But, you know, you could have a libel commissioner, maybe. You could do it, you know, like the divorce courts or you know, other types of mediation. And in fact, libel is one of the few areas of civil law that doesn't have any other forum other than the High Court in London. So even if it was taken to the county court, you would be paying the lawyers a little bit less than the high-flying QCs in
London. With libel, I was kind of surprised to read this on the Penn website, that there is this contingency fee basis
yeah
that means if you lose,
yeah,
you could be paying... It is total casino. You could be paying double what lawyers would charge in any case. So you'd
sure
be paying £800,000 an hour.
And we think that's something that Parliament are going to tweak, actually, to actually limit the no-win, no-fee win bonus to 25%.
Because mediation, people may not be familiar with it. Mediation is where everybody sits down and tries to actually resolve it with a third party neutral. Mm. Arbitration is where the parties agree on somebody who is going to make the decision, who's not a judge, and you can move things along more quickly. So both of those would be, I think, logical alternatives.
That's a very clear explanation of the terms. Do you want to join our advisory committee?
I'm a mediator and an arbitrator here.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
I do both, and I do quite a lot of both.
I'll send you an email right after this show on that basis. You might have yourself a job.
So if we do stamp out libel tourism in the UK, aren't the libel tourists just going to run to Italy or France where libel's a crime?
Maybe. I mean, this is the worry, and maybe, you know, Italy and France need better laws. But because the costs are out of will be taken out, the costs in Italy and France are much less. Journalists will be able to defend themselves. They'll be emboldened. Publishers won't be shy of publishing something because they know it's not going to cost them hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds to do it.
Well, I also thought it was comforting that the writer who brought criminal libel charges in France against a book reviewer was just ordered to pay £6,900 in damages to the poor guy who reviewed her book as a result of the abusive character of her actions. So maybe they do have some sense about free speech.
That's interesting, Donna, because I know we reported on that a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that's just happened.
Great result. Good. Slapper.
Well, instead of, you know, being the shameful location in the world for these things, actually, if things do get reformed in the way that Robert and Penn wants, I mean, we might actually lead Europe and we might, you know, end up setting some standards in this area, which would be a nice thing.
Well, that's the plan. Once we, if and when we get success in this bill, and I should say it's a draft bill, so the MPs are going to scrutinise it, there's going to be a consultation. The government's not actually going to introduce the actual bill through Parliament until next year, until May 2012.
Oh, goodness.
So
who knows? I mean, who knows? We've got a coalition here, Donna. It might not hold until then. So it's very much up in the air right now.
One last question. Are we all going to get sued for libel now?
If you do, if you're responsible, then no. But if you start telling lies about people, then perhaps. One thing but that's okay because you'll be able to defend yourself and you'll have strong defences of truth, of fair comment, of honest opinion. And when you go to court, it won't cost you as much. So we just think that a world where there's a lot of robust, noisy argument where people are publishing things and maybe retracting them and correcting themselves, that's a better democracy than a silent place where no one says anything and the rich businessmen, the wealthy oligarchs get to sort of manage their reputation.
Good luck with the libel reform campaign. I hope you'll keep us posted on your progress.
Thank you very much for having us on. And please go to libelreform.org, sign up wherever you are in the world and tell the UK Parliament they need to reform our libel laws.
That's all for this edition of The Debriefer. Join us in 2 weeks for more on Writing in the Law.